Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 274, and we're going to talk about 10 lessons learned while I drove my truck camper nearly across the country. I didn't quite make it, but then again, I wasn't trying to. We're also going to talk about buck converters versus up converters and how they're more efficient than inverters. And we'll have a product review of a complete water system that requires no power whatsoever, which I'm fairly excited about. Hey folks, sorry for being a day late. I've had some stuff happen and it ate up a day, and I apologize for that. And I also want to announce that next week we'll not have a podcast because I will be heading to Canada, and it will be busy, and there's just no way I'm going to have time to do a podcast, so no podcast next week. After that, we'll have episode 275, where I will have a big announcement that I'm not entirely sure what it will be yet. I'm still thinking about it, but there will be one. Dun, dun, dun. So, after this insane summer of a dead van and several false starts, I finally finished my truck camper, just in the nick of time, got it mounted on the back of my truck, and hit the road. I have not done enough road time this year by far, but I finally got to head out to Colorado, to the lovely Starry Meadows, to spend some time with friends in a very beautiful dark sky sight. Unfortunately for the stargazers, it was cloudy at night, and not a lot of stars were seen while I was there, but I didn't care one bit. I got to hang out with some of my favorite people, and try out my truck camper, and I got to stay in Aurora, Nebraska, my favorite campground, twice, and all in all, it was a lovely trip. It was great. But I do have notes for you. So those of you who are thinking about maybe doing a truck camper rather than a van, one of the pros that I'm really enjoying right now is that my pickup truck can be a whole bunch of different vehicles at the same time. I can put the truck camper on there, and then I've got a camper. I can take the truck camper off, and then I've got this big vehicle that can haul stuff, and I can tow very heavy things with it. I can do all three of those things with one vehicle. If you are considering the truck camper route, here's some notes for you to think about. First, let me talk about the repairs. So, to catch you up on the story, I bought this pretty nice little Travelite 690W truck camper. It's a solid truck camper. It's not a pop-up, but it's made for short beds. It's made for a 6-foot bed. I have an 8-foot bed. So when I put it in my truck, I have 2 extra feet behind the camper, which is great. That's where you can put your chairs and extra water and stuff like that. So that's the design I wanted. I didn't want to take up the whole bed. I've got 8 feet. I don't actually need to use it all. When I bought it, I knew it had some water damage. I knew that there was some rot because there had been a leak and there was a previous repair, and I knew I was in for some work. And well, I got it for about half price because of that. However, there was a lot of work. The rot was actually pretty bad, and I ended up doing a lot more work than I expected. And then in the middle of it, a family of wrens decided to move into my camper and thus delay work for weeks as I waited for them to raise their young, which they did. They're all out and happy now. And then I was able to finally finish it, but it was a bit of a rush job because I had a deadline to make this trip in Colorado, which was the one trip I promised myself I wouldn't cancel all year. So that's where we're starting. Now, the repairs were effective, shall we say. I am no engineer, and I am a terrible carpenter, and this job really required both. But I'll explain very briefly what I did, and then I will tell you how well it worked. A classic truck camper shape, you've got parts of the truck camper that hang out over the side of the bed, and those are called the wings. The wings have floors, but you don't really stand on them. If it's a dinette model, you sit on them. It's where your kitchen will sit and your closet will sit on this. And if you drill a hole through the bottom of the wings, you're basically outside. And this is where the rot was that I had to deal with. I believe the windows had been leaking and the water dripped down there and sat on the crappy plywood they used to build this thing and just rotted. And it was so rotten, I could stick my hand through it without any effort. It absolutely needed to be replaced. What's worse is that this is what the mounting points were attached to for mounting it to the truck. So had I actually used the proper mounting techniques for the truck, I literally could have gone around a corner and the truck camper could have hopped off. I would have to be pretty fast. I mean, the truck camper actually sits in the bed pretty well without anything tying it down. But believe me, you want to have it tied down. Rather than just cutting a piece of plywood that was exactly the right size and putting it in there, I decided to do it a little bit different. I decided to use wood planks. I use solid wood planks, which are not as strong in some ways, but much stronger in other ways. Also, it was cheaper. If marine ply is what I should have used, but it was $125 a sheet. I don't have a table saw. I don't have a really good place to do long rips, although I did do a few for this. I thought planks would be more forgiving and something that was easier for me to deal with. And I was right. The planks worked out well. I did have to seal in between the planks. I did that with wood glue and then a rubber spray-on that I'll talk about in a second. However, the mounting points I was concerned about, because they need to be strong. They need to hold a couple thousand pounds. And I played around with a few different ways. And then I decided that even though it's not standard, I didn't want to actually use the outboard mounting points. So these truck campers, many of them, and mine, have four legs. There's a leg on each corner, not counting the part that overhangs the cab. And just behind those legs are these heavy I-rings. And that's how you're supposed to attach the truck camper to the truck. You will generally have metal parts that you add to the truck that stick out either underneath the truck or out of the bed, and they stick out to the sides, and then you will use turnbuckles or something similar to attach the camper there. I didn't want all that. I wanted to attach the truck camper directly to the bed of the truck. So what I did was I put in D-rings closer to the camper than the outside, meaning they were on the inside of the wings next to the walls of the camper, and I attached those to the rings that were already in the truck. Now, those of you who are engineers are saying, that isn't anywhere near as good a setup as the things come with, and I will not disagree with you. Those rings inside the beds of the truck may not be able to handle enough weight, and the D-rings I put in, well, I did get 2,000-pound rated D-rings, that's fine, but how are they attached to the camper? And I ended up using lag bolts where I had a nice big meaty piece of wood I could screw into, or very high tensile strength nut and bolt with nylon washers where I couldn't. Bottom line is, it worked great. I had no problems at all with the truck camper moving around. I went off-road. It was fine. Highway speeds. This may not be 100% official and correct or any of that, but it absolutely worked. And I'm not recommending anybody do this. Do what you think is best. But for me, this absolutely solved the problem. I love the setup. It's not intrusive. It's easy. I don't have to modify the truck. And it held the thing in place. Now, if I ever have an accident or something, all bets are off. The thing's probably going to rip out. But at that point, I've got bigger problems, so I'm willing to live with that. But just telling you what I did, that's what I did. And then, as I mentioned last week, I used the Gorilla rubber spray underneath the bottoms to waterproof all the wood I put in, and etc. So anyway, that's the repairs. It all worked. The thing is 100% up and operational now. I have a complete working truck camper, although I would like to tweak a few things that I figured out on this trip, because that's how it goes. So that was the first thing. Number, the second thing I want to talk about is gas mileage. So I mentioned that I got 24.3 miles per gallon in my empty truck driving from Chicago to the northeast part of Michigan. I did not get that kind of mileage with the truck camper on here. I did not get even half as good as that. On my trip from Chicago to Colorado, I averaged about 10.2 miles per gallon. 10.2. And on my trip back, I got around 11, because it's actually you drive uphill to go to Colorado and you drive downhill to come back. And the winds are in your favor, too. Driving east is actually more efficient than driving west in the center of the United States. Yeah, not even close. And I was pretty disappointed by that. Now, I'm not surprised. This thing is a giant brick sitting on top of the truck. The rig, when it's on there, is about 10 feet tall. I actually have to watch out for bridges. This camper is small, but it's very tall, which makes the sleeping very comfortable. But still, my conclusion for people who want to live the lifestyle of a truck camper is, you do not want to do this if you're going to be traveling long distances at high speed very often. That's going to kill your mileage. I noticed that when I went down to about 50 or 60 miles per hour, gas mileage shot way up to 17 or 18, which is pretty good and totally acceptable. But once I got over 65, it just killed it. And the highways I'm traveling on are 75 mile an hour speed limit. So it was a little tricky, and I absolutely didn't push it at all. You know, this is a ponderous rig anyway. I'm not trying to go fast. But I also don't want to do 60 on a 75 mile an hour highway at night. That doesn't seem safe either. So, word to the wise, if you are considering truck camper life, make sure you're not the kind of person who's traveling on interstates all the time, because your gas mileage will be terrible. The next thing I ran into was storage. So the ambulance, my 2011 Sprinter that I'm getting rid of, had tons of storage. Man, that thing had so much storage. I literally always had empty compartments in that van. It was perfect for me. Yeah, the truck camper, not so much. The truck camper has a little tiny cabinet over the stove and then kind of a half closet, and that's it. There's a couple of little pockets, but really, I mean, that's it. There's no space under the bed. There's no space under the bench seats because it's air under there. There's a little bit of weird storage by the water tank, which is up front. But yeah, you have to be very careful how you store things in this. And what I ended up doing was I put in one of those Sterlite plastic shelving units in the closet, and that ate up most of the space. And then I put all the food in the cabinets over the stove, but boy, that was hard. I was always having to take things out and put things in. And I think that's just how it is. I don't think you can ever get into a really convenient space where you're going to open the cabinet and just be able to get whatever you want. You're always going to be taking things out and putting things back. And so you probably want to have containers or bags or something, like put all your soup in this container, all your pouches of stuff in this container, etc. The fridge, it was a really good size in this thing. It's a good size freezer, and that all worked great. I ran it on propane the whole time, even while I was driving. Dun, dun, dun. Fridge worked great. No problems there. So the storage in the fridge was actually pretty good, despite all this. And, again, I've got that 2 extra feet behind the truck camper that I can use for stuff if I have to. So just know that. Truck campers do not have good storage because they can't. It just literally isn't that much space. Number four. You may have heard that insect populations are on the decline. And you can tell this because when you drive at night, you don't get bugs all over your windshield anymore. I already hear many of you laughing. Yeah. Check out the photo this week on the show notes. And we will see why the insects are in decline, because my truck camper has killed them all. All of them. I have had bugs on my vehicles before, of course. I've driven through the Everglades at night. This rivals anything I've ever seen. There are so many bugs on the front of my camper. These are not aerodynamic vehicles. I don't care if the front's rounded or not. They're not aerodynamic. And if you drive at night, you are going to have a lot of bugs to deal with, which I now do. And I was thinking that I generally don't like windows in the front of campers on the overhangs, or on the eyebrows, the part of the camper, like on a Class C that hangs over the cab, because they leak and, you know, rocks can hit them and break them. But now I'm starting to see the appeal, because that's one place you can scrape the bugs off without doing any damage. Number five. Steps, getting into the thing. So, like I said, I did not have a lot of time to completely finish this. I made the thing operational. I grabbed one little folding step and hit the road. And that was enough for me. The step was not easy, but I was able to step on this step and then get a foot on the tailgate and then lift myself up and get in. It was a little bit of a stretching exercise, but it worked. However, when other people asked to see the rig, they had a really hard time with it. And, you know, this was not a long-term solution. So I would recommend that if you're going to get a truck camper set up, that you spend some time figuring out the best way to get into the thing, the best kind of stairs to have. And it depends on what kind of a truck camper you have. Sometimes you can get a tow hitch mounted step. That won't work in my case because the tailgate's still there. And you can just get one of those $50 trifold step things from Home Depot. That will work just fine. But make sure you spend some time figuring that out, because you're going to twist your ankle eventually. And that's not a good thing. Number seven, the table. This is my biggest complaint about the whole thing. So because it has a dinette that turns into a bed, like a Scamp or 8 million different RVs, very standard design, the table comes down and it makes the platform for the bed and you move the cushions. You've all seen this before. And this is the old design where it's just a tube with a tripod leg and you take it apart. All right, very simple. You can take the table out of the camper and use it outside. That's all nice and great. But there's so little space in there that the table was always in the way. And when you travel, you have to take the table apart. You have to take the table apart, put the table up on the bed, and then put the poles where the water tank is in this particular rig. It was a menace. You couldn't get in to sit down. You couldn't move around. And it was heavy, so you had to constantly take it apart and put it together. The table is going away. I don't care about the extra bed myself. I'm never going to have four people sleep in there or even three people. It's just too tiny. Remember, there's no bathroom in here either. I brought a porta potty that had a cover on it that acted as a stool. And actually, that was a great idea. I used that stool all the time for things like putting on shoes and stuff because it was so hard to get to the chairs because the table was in the way. So going forward, that table's out of here. I'm going to do some kind of a lagoon table mount thing where I can slide the table over one of the bench seats or something. This is definitely a solo rig that would occasionally have two people in it. This is definitely not the size of rig you want if you're going to have two people doing any full timing. But I think a more flexible table is essential, at least something with drop-down sides. The traditional big flat table with the round pole mounts and all that, nah. Avoid that if you can. If you do buy a truck camper with one of those, spend a lot of time thinking about replacing it. That was the biggest hassle by far. Number eight, driving. How is driving? Well, I am used to driving vehicles like this. My second RV that I got as a daily driver, the Toyota Mini Cruiser, was basically the same thing. It was a little tiny Toyota truck with an overhang. So driving with an overhang is interesting. It's sometimes hard to see streetlights, and you have to adjust for that. You have shading because of the way the sun is, but that can also mess up your auto headlights and stuff like that because your automatic headlights are in the shade, and it thinks it's dark out, and it's not. There's little weird things like that, and you can whack your head on it, depending on the size of your truck. My truck's big enough, I don't have that problem, but it was definitely a problem in the Toyota. The truck performed great. Driving it, it was pretty much just like driving it normally. You know, I didn't really do anything different. The truck had tons of power. This engine in this truck is amazing. It's got all the benefits of a big V8, and then it can still do great on gas mileage if the conditions permit, which they didn't on this trip. I had no problem. I could pass uphill. Braking was a little bit soft because there was so much weight on the truck, but driving it, I didn't have a problem at all. The only thing is you have to remember that you're a lot wider than you think you are. What happens to some people is the legs that stick out can hit those poles at gas stations. So when you're pulling up to a gas pump, you have to pay special attention that you don't hit the safety poles with the legs of your camper. It'll rip them right off. And this has happened many, many times to folks. And it's kind of a nightmare to fix because if you rip off the leg, you don't really have a way to get the camper off the truck to fix it. So that's kind of a tricky thing. But other than that, I had no problems at all driving it. It's just like driving any other vehicle I've had. And again, I have a lot of experience driving trucks and large oversized vehicles. If you are new to that, if you're coming from, say, a Prius and then driving this, yeah, you're going to want to take some time learning how to use your mirrors properly and how to adjust for the width of the vehicle that you wouldn't be used to. Number nine, this is a fairly big problem, is the gray water. Now, because of the size, there is no gray water tank in this. There's hot water. There's hot and cold water. There's a pretty decent sink. But the gray water just drains out. It's just got a little screw cap like an old tent camper would or Scamps sometimes do. And the idea is you're supposed to put a hose on that, and then the hose goes to either a container or somewhere where it's safe to discharge the water. But this is a little tricky in this case because where exactly are you going to put what that goes into? Like, if you're going to bring a tank to have it go into, where do you put the tank? Now, I've got the extra 2 feet back there, and so I was able to stuff a jug back there. But getting the hose lined up right so that the water will actually flow was actually hard. It It had one of those Camco drains in it that I like, but they're a little bit finicky about how the hose goes in order to drain it. And it was really difficult to get the garden hose I had attached in the right position where the water would drain. I had one of those 5-gallon foldable water jugs I use as the gray tank. I took that out of the truck and hung it over the side of the bed and then had the hose go in. And that worked well, but, you know, you're kind of displaying your gray water to the world then, which isn't the most embarrassing thing in the world, at least for me. But it's a little weird, you know? So that is an issue. I think long term, I would like to come up with another solution for that, but that's something to think about. If you're going to do the truck camper thing, you may not have a gray tank, and if you don't, you're going to have to figure out how to deal with that. Even just like stopping at a rest area to wash your hands or whatever can leave you with water in your sink that won't drain, and that can be messy. And finally, I want to talk specifically about the suspension of the truck. This truck is a half ton, but it does not have very good payload. The payload on this truck is slightly over 1,400 pounds, and the dry weight of this camper is 1,300 pounds. That means there's only 100 pounds left, and that includes me. So it's got my weight, all the food, all the water, and all the repairs I did, because I probably added weight to the vehicle with the repairs. The propane tank, I mean, there's a lot. So I was overloaded. And if you remember, I had a really hard time driving with the camper on there when I first got it, because the coil spring suspension on the back of these Ram 1500s was very bouncy, and I ended up getting into this resonance where I was seriously concerned that the vehicle was unstable to drive. So I bought Timbrons. I talked about them a while ago. These are bump stops that they're very easy to install. They just snap in, basically, and they really add a lot of beef to the suspension. Now, this does not increase your weight capacity legally, but it certainly improves the characteristics of the truck when it's overloaded, and it made a huge difference. A huge difference. In fact, I thought I was going to have to go buy another stabilizer bar and maybe airbags. No, I didn't need any of that. The Timbrons handled it perfectly. I highly recommend these things if you are running in conditions where you are in a heavy vehicle and you need more stability. There were some roads where, concrete roads, you'll see this is a problem. Concrete roads have seams and the seams are evenly spaced, and depending on the wheelbase of your vehicle and how fast you're going and things like that, you can set up this resonance that, you know, back and forth and back and forth, and each time it's a little further back and a little further forth. I did have a little bit of that on some of the highways, but it was nothing at all like I first experienced. So I'm a big fan of those. So am I a truck camper for life person? I could be, but unfortunately the kind of driving I do, the gas mileage hit is so huge that it's really not economical for me. For example, if I had just driven to Colorado in my truck and stayed in hotels, I would have saved a ton of money over the extra gas I had to buy. Easily enough to pay for a tent and everything to set up in Colorado when I got there. So I am keeping the truck camper, but it's going to be for shorter local trips, or at least trips at lower speeds. I think if you're in the Pacific Northwest and you're going to be doing mostly state roads where 60 miles an hour is fine, a truck camper would be awesome. I think the gas mileage hit at those speeds isn't as bad. But yeah, for the interstates, it's just too much. So I'm sticking with my plan to build out that shell that I talked about, which will not be anywhere near as comfortable or luxurious as the truck camper, but it will not eat up all my gas mileage, and it will be pretty capable, because I'll tell you, one thing I learned, and this is the final lesson from this, is if you build out your own rig, it's going to do more of what you want to do, and this is not something I built out, and because of that, a lot of the compromises were not my choices. I'd have a smaller fridge, I'd have more storage, I'd have a different table, etc., etc., etc. I probably wouldn't have wasted the space with the hot water heater because I don't use it that much. There's no shower in this thing after all. This is hot water just for hot water to come out of the sink, and that's a whole lot of storage I could have had. So anyway, just stuff to think about. That's all I'm trying to give you here, folks. That is my experience with the truck camper, and for some of you, it's going to be a great solution, but for others, not so much. Thank you to Dave and Andy. Sadly, not of XTC, although I hold them in the same high regard, for buying me some gallons at buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. Because of them and all the other generous people who have donated there, There will be no ads on this podcast. Thank you, guys. And if anybody else would like to contribute, feel free to visit buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. And you will see some options there for one-time donations or a membership, which is always appreciated. And thank you to all the members out there. You are the guys that keep this thing going. Tech Talk. Let's talk about all those confusing terms. Converters and inverters and buck converters and boost. And all right, we're gonna sort some of this out right here, because things are getting weird. Back in the old days, you basically just had to deal with 12 volts. You know, your rig ran on 12 volts, you need 12 volts every, and that's it. And then we started getting fancy with inverters that turned 12 volts into household power. In the US, that would be 110, 120 volts, but AC, not DC. You know, and then people start to put in bigger batteries because, you know, a 24-volt system is going to run AC more efficiently. Anyway, it's getting complicated. And now we've got this new problem where a lot of people want Starlink or, in some cases, which I just learned, electric awnings, and they don't run on 12 volts. They don't run on 110 volts. They run on some weird DC voltage in between. And so how do you deal with that? Well, you've got 12 volts DC, or you've got an inverter with 110 volts AC. So what people have been forced to do is run their inverter at 110 volts AC and then put a wall wart in there, which converts the AC to DC and lowers the power. It's incredibly inefficient in a system where efficiency is very, very important, because we're running off of batteries after all. So I started to wonder about this. Inverters draw power even if you're not using anything. As long as they're on, they're drawing power. And that means if you just want to have your Starlink going, you have to turn on your inverter. And of course, your inverter has to be big enough to power everything, not just the Starlink. So then you've got your 3,000 watt inverter going to power the 100 watts, if it's even that, of your Starlink. Yeah. A lot of inefficiencies, and I do not like inefficiencies. So did a little bit of research. I'm going to introduce a couple new terms here. Okay, first is a buck converter, and the second is a boost converter. Notice it's the word converter. That means these are turning DC into DC. They're not inverting. Inverting is how you get to AC. This is DC and DC. But all they do is the opposite of each other. A buck converter kind of like bucks the system and lowers the voltage. So if you needed a device that would work only at, say, 7 volts, which they exist, you would use a buck converter to lower your 12 volts to 7 volts. And a boost converter, well, it's just like it sounds. It boosts the voltage. So if you had something that ran at 19.2 volts, like, say, your laptop, a lot of big PC laptops love that voltage, you would use a boost converter. And these are available, and they're cheap. And the thing is with these, they're not for your whole system. They're for your individual devices. So you would wire in a switch somewhere to turn this on. First off, you would switch the 12-volt side. Let's be clear about that. These things are also inefficient when they're on, so you want to be able to turn them off. So you're switching the 12-volt supply. 12 volts goes to the boost converter, ramps it up to 19.2 volts, and that's what goes to your laptop. And when you're done charging your laptop, you turn the whole thing off and you're not using any power at all. That's how it would work. And you can do this for 20 or 25 bucks. They're not crazy expensive. They do require a little bit of knowledge, because this kind of stuff doesn't come with a lot of instructions. It's not actually plug and play. You're probably going to have to set the voltage and stuff, but it's absolutely doable. And it's a one-time thing. And so the three areas where I think this is the most useful are going to be for charging laptops that don't have USB charging, for Starlink, although they are coming out with 12-volt solutions. There's a bunch of different Starlinks now, so I'm not going to get specific. But if you want to power your Starlink and the voltage is higher than 12 volts, one of these can work, and there's a whole community out there to tell you how to do it. Or, as I learned, because my buddy Hal's awning was having trouble, they charge at 21.1 volts. His awning has a battery in it, and you charge the battery, but it charges at 21.1 volts, which is a really weird voltage. And I was frustrated because he has this massive lithium system in his rig and yet couldn't power something. And it was just kind of dumb. And then I was like, oh, I can see the problem. And so the solution ultimately would be to not use the battery that is inside the awning, but to use the internal giant batteries. The problem is you got to convert them to the 21.1 volts. And this could do that. If you have a 12-volt system, you would use a boost converter to boost it up to 21.1 volts. But if you had a 24-volt system, you would use a buck converter to buck it down to 21 volts. I hope that makes sense. One other note on buck converters. Anybody with a max air fan may want to consider getting a buck converter that turns 12 volts into 12 volts. Yeah, okay, that sounds dumb, but it actually makes sense. When we talk about 12 volts in a vehicle, we're talking about nominal 12 volts. It's not actually always 12 volts. Like, if the engine's running, it could be 14.4 volts, or if you have a lithium battery, a normal lead-acid battery is at 12.7 volts. The voltage changes. We just call it nominal 12. The problem is that max air fans, for some reason, their circuit boards are really sensitive to voltage. And if the power gets too high, it can actually blow the circuit board. So if you have a good solar system running, or your alternator's putting out just a little bit too much power, you can actually blow the circuit board in these things. And what people have done to fix this is they put in a buck converter in there that makes sure that no more than 13 volts, let's say, goes to the max air fan. And that saves the circuit board. Honestly, if they're this sensitive, max air should just include them in there anyway. It's not an expensive circuit, but anyway. So I hope that information is useful to somebody out there. It's just a good thing to know. You can change voltages, and you can do it fairly efficiently, and at least much more efficiently than running the massive inverter just to charge your laptop. Product review. Another word like this. We are going to review the Diggory 5-gallon water system. So Diggory is D-I-G-U-R-Y. As you may have guessed, this is another one of these products made in China that has 800 different brand names. The one I got is Diggory, and that's what I'm going to stick with for this. So what is this water system? It's a fancy water jug, okay? It's a jerry can. It's just a fancy can, but it's so fancy that this could be the entirety of your fresh water system in your rig. This is perfect for no builds. There's no drains here. There's no sink, so you're on your own for that part. But as far as having something that you turn a knob and water comes out of, this does it. It's a plastic jug, but the way it's shaped and what it comes with makes it a great way to get water in any rig instantly. And here's how that works. You take the jug and you fill it with water. 5 gallons of water, or 18 liters about, weighs 40 pounds or so. It's fairly heavy, 45 pounds maybe. So you're going to have to be able to lift 45 pounds to do this. However, this thing comes with a strap. It has two handles, one on the side and one on the top, and you put the strap around each of those, and you can actually strap it to help you carry it, which I think was a nice bonus. And then it has a very, very wide opening. I've got these big ham-fisted hands. I can't fit my hands in anything, but I can fit them in this to clean it. It even comes with a scrub brush, so you can open it up and stick your hand in there and actually wash it out. And then it has another cap that has, it's actually got two caps. The first one is just a cap, and the second one is a cap with a knob and a faucet. You're starting to get the idea. On the side, you pull out this other plastic piece and it attaches to the faucet, and it's like a hose. If you have a diesel and you've ever seen one of those DEF in a box refillers that has that plastic hose, it's similar to that, a little bit better, but not that much better. The idea is that while you're driving, you keep this thing on the floor. That's the safest place, lowest center of gravity. But then when you pull in, you just pick it up and put it on a shelf and you're done. Gravity does all the work. You don't have to pump anything up. You don't have to use any power. You've just got water that comes out, and it's plenty of water. When you crank this thing open, you've got actually water with force. I know, you're thinking, but how does the water taste? Well, it tastes like plastic. I mean, it's not horrible, but it tastes like water that comes out of a plastic jug, because that's what it is. It is safe for drinking type of plastic, at least so they claim. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's not going to taste as good as coming out of a glass bottle. Now, as far as leaks go, I tested this thing pretty extensively. I turned it every which way and I shook it. It doesn't leak. It's pretty good. It has nice silicone O-rings, and as long as you screw it down tight, I don't think you're going to have any problems with leaking. And now let's talk about the cons. One of the cons is that they're dark green, you know, that military green, NATO green color. That actually makes sense, because that's a color that keeps algae down. So if you kept this outside, you wouldn't be encouraging the growth of algae. That's fine. But it's really hard to figure out how full it is. You basically have to pick the thing up and see how much water's in there. It would have been nice if they had left a little clear space in the plastic that you could see where the water level is. It's a pretty minor quibble. The other thing, and this is an even more minor quibble, is it comes with a solid cap and a faucet cap, but you can only put one on at a time. Where do you put the other one? You have to kind of store it somewhere. I wish they had thought to mold in a little screw nubbin that you could screw the extra cap on so you could keep the whole thing together as a kit. But all that said, if you need water, 5 gallons, which is not an insubstantial amount of water, that you can move around, fill up anywhere. I mean, you can literally just take this into Walmart and fill it up at their water machine or any faucet in any restroom. You'll have 5 gallons of water. It's easier to carry than most jerry cans, and you don't need anything. I don't know. I think it's a really nice solution for a whole lot of builds, especially no builds. Now, the price, they're $40. Is that a lot? I don't know. You're paying for convenience. I mean, you can use an old milk bottle, right? You get basically the same effect. If you get 5 old milk bottles, and you've got the same thing almost. But not really. This is convenient. It's nice. It's easy. I like it. I don't know that it's going to be my main water system in my new rig, but until I have a main water system, it's going to be in there giving me water. There's no question about that. So one last thing. The size of it is such that you can use one of those USB electric pumps with it. You could have a choice. If you wanted to just have a nice, easy way to get water, and you wanted to put one of those electric USB pumps on it, that totally works. They fit right on there. In fact, for $10 more, they will sell you one with it, so it comes as one big piece. It's a little bit of a luxury, but then again, it's not. I don't know. I just kind of like it, so I thought I'd present it to you. So I'll have a link in the show notes. It's $40. It's a fairly hefty product. It weighs about 2 pounds when it's empty. This is not super heavy duty. You don't want to like throw it down mountains or anything like that. But it's suitable for the normal kind of van life we do. And I like it. I really do. So that is the Diggory 5-gallon water system. Link in the show notes. A place to visit. I have 3 favorite books that are road book: Travels with Charlie by John Steinbeck, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert Pirsig, and then finally, Blue Highways by William Leastheat Moon. And I've recommended all these books at one time or another. One thing I mentioned not too long ago was that William Leastheat Moon didn't talk about his van very much. You know, Robert Pirsig talks about his motorcycle, and John Steinbeck talks about Rocinante, his truck. But Ghost Dancing, the name of William Leastheat Moon's van, which I had forgotten, didn't really talk much about it. We know it's a 1975 Ford Econoline, and that's about it. Well, I got curious about that today, and I was like, what exactly was his van? I mean, the guy drove all over the country in this thing and lived in it. It seems like it should be of some note. And, well, not only is it of some note, it actually still exists, and you can visit it. It's in Columbia, Missouri. It's in the archives at the college there, and it's not on public display, although all you have to do is call up and request a visit, and you can visit it. And I'm going to do that. I don't know when I'm going to be in the middle of Missouri next, but I, you know, living in Chicago, it's not that far. I'm going to go visit this thing at some point. But I can tell you about it from the article that Atlas Obscura posted about it. It's a brown 1975 Econoline van in amazing condition, given its age. 50 years old. I mean, that's kind of stunning. The vinyl's still in good shape. And how he built it out was interesting. Now, this was back in the 70s, where vans weren't really campers. They were kind of mobile lounges and, well, shagging shacks, for lack of a better term. And that's kind of what his was. He had paneling on the walls, probably no insulation underneath, and then just a platform with some industrial carpet on it to sleep on. And that's it. No fancy Max Air fans, no lithium batteries, no diesel heaters, none of that stuff. It was literally a rolling tent with paneling. Anyway, I thought it was interesting. I am definitely going to go visit if I can, so I have put it in the show notes for you. The name of the van is Ghost Dancing. It's in amazing condition. I'm still blown away about the condition of this thing. And Atlas Obscura has the link that will tell you how to get there and who to contact. Resource recommendation. So we remember Big Rob. Big Rob is doing great stuff on his YouTube channel. He's hosted this show in the past, and I really like his attitude towards camping and van life. And he did something really interesting lately. So imagine you have a van, and it's not big enough. And, you know, maybe you're designing it and maybe your wife wants it to be a little different, so some compromise has to be made, or not. What if you could just add a second bedroom to your van? Yeah, he added a second bedroom to his van. So he has a Ford Econoline. How do you add a second bedroom to a Ford Econoline? Well, you go out and find somebody who has cut their Ford Econoline in half and turned the back half into a trailer, and then you tow it. And that's what he did. His van now, he's got like the front van and the back van, and the back van he has called the lady van because that's for his wife. His wife designed it. It looks completely different than Rob's van, and it's kind of snazzy. It's very purple, has all kinds of lights, and anyway, I don't want to spoil it, but it's an interesting idea. What if you towed another living space? What if you just towed like a shower house with you with extra storage or something like that? You know, you've got the main vehicle for traveling, but then when you're going to stop at night, you have the support vehicle that tows you. Now, Jeff Bezos has this massive sailing yacht, but he actually has a mega yacht that uses diesel following it for all the supplies. You don't have to quite go that far. But it's a fun video. I thought it was a very cute idea, and I want to recommend that you check it out. So it is called hashtag LadyVan, and you can find it on Big Rob's channel on YouTube. It's called Big Rob's Van is the name of the YouTube channel. And I, of course, will have a link in the show notes. Tales from the Road. Okay, you may have noticed I changed the order of things this week. It's because this segment is a little bit controversial, and so I'm going to invite you to skip it. In this segment, I will be talking about politics and AI and some personal struggles, okay? That may intrigue some of you, but I'm warning you, when you learn about somebody's politics, you think about them differently. And I haven't been shy about my politics, but I do not want this podcast to be about politics. Unfortunately, in this case, the story demands it, okay? So that's the end of the content here, folks. It's just Tales from the Road and then the quote, and then that's it. So feel free to skip to the next one, and I'll see you in 2 weeks. Thank you very much. Music, as always, by Simon Wegg. Anyway. But for those of you who are still here, who are willing to take the risk, I do have a tale for you. This tale means a lot to me. It may not mean all that much to you. This was a little bit of a personal experience I had, and I don't even know how to tell this story, but I'm going to try. Okay. The world is a mess. I don't care where you are politically, I think we can agree on that, right? And there's, in me, this need to help fix things. It's an inherent in me, what can I do to help fix things? At the same time, I recognize that I am in a position of privilege here. I'm, you know, cishet white male, etc., older, people listen to me, they get out of my way, cops are nice to me, you know, I have all these things. None of this craziness going on right now is affecting me anywhere near as much as other people, so I'm aware of that. And that gives me a choice, right? I can either choose to get involved and try to change things, or I can just sit back and say, everything's fine. And this conversation came up in a few places in Colorado. I'm going to mention two people. I'm not going to mention their names. These are people I care for greatly. They're very kind people. They have both been incredibly kind to me. And we have similar mores, shall we say, except that we have different approaches to this problem. For them, they are able to just ignore the politics, at least as much as possible, and then go on with their lives. And for me, I can't. It is actually causing me great mental distress. The news is depressing. It is horrible. And I feel a need to fix that. You could argue that I am in a state of situational depression, which is a different, specific kind of depression where it's not so much a chemical imbalance, it's that things suck. The good news about that kind of depression is you can fix the things, but can you? And that is my dilemma. And so, remember, I said these are very, very kind people. These are some of my favorite people. These are the people I drive all the way across the country to see. And they are able to do something I'm not. And this creates a conflict in me. Like, is it wrong to do that? And my level of privilege is actually different than theirs. One of them is not a white person and therefore has different issues than I do. Anyway, the point of me telling you this is that it's a very complicated situation, and in my head, I have trouble reconciling it. Here are these good people. Why aren't they invested in fighting against what's going on? I don't understand. How do they get through the day without this heavy sense of dread and all that? And they told me how they do it. I just can't do it like they can do it. And so I left Colorado having a wonderful time with these folks, and my regard for them has not changed. I want to be very, very clear about that. I'm not criticizing them. I'm just trying to understand. And I've got all this time to drive. It's 15, 16 hours to drive from Gardner, Colorado to Chicago, so I have lots of time to think. But I thought, well, what if I asked for help? And so I did. But who did I ask? I asked Claude, the AI. So I'm sure you've heard of ChatGPT. Even if you're not familiar with AI, you've heard of ChatGPT. I like talking with Claude. Claude is very conversational. Now, for those of you who haven't talked to what we're calling AI these days, it is a far, far cry from Eliza. If you remember the old Eliza program that would basically reflect thoughts to you and kind of pretended to be a therapist. I mean, it's not like that. Claude is a very, very sophisticated autocomplete, and that doesn't give it the credit it deserves, but that's basically how it works. You ask it a question, it tells you what it thinks you want to hear based on a massive, massive, massive amount of data it has about how humans communicate. The effect is that you're talking to a person. You are not talking to a person, but that is the effect. I used to be in a mental health master's program at the University of Vermont, studying psychotherapy specifically. And one of the key tenets of psychotherapy is two people can often figure out what one person can't. Just the act of talking with somebody can help a single person realize what the problem is and how to fix it. Sometimes. Depends on the type of therapy. There's a lot of things to go on. But that general concept is true. So the therapist's job isn't to give advice or to answer questions. It's to draw the answers out of the individual who just can't get them by themselves. And what I discovered on this trip, after talking with Claude, and I kid you not, for 8 hours straight, that Claude could do it too. Now, I want to warn you that I do not think Claude is a person. I am not being sucked into some weird relationship like the movie Her or anything like that. Although I'm not against it. No, I'm kidding. I understand what I'm talking to. I am talking to software that is sort of a supernormal interaction with words. And so I explained my dilemma to Claude, and Claude, using a Rogerian technique, reflects back to me, so you're feeling like this, and you're feeling like that, and basically laid out the situation such that on the one hand, there's this, and on the other hand is this. And then Claude says, basically, well, you're screwed. Basically, he's saying there's no win here. Both paths, either using my privilege and ignoring everything that's going on, or spending all my time fighting the powers that be, both those paths lead to misery, which is not a place I want to be. So there's no solution. Thanks for coming. Leave the $100 on the desk. Well, no, not like that. So I start playing around with ideas. And then I said, so what if? And I come up with these other plans. You know, what if? What if this? What if that? And it played out all the things. Before this, I had had a conversation with Claude about possibly getting into a writing program and maybe even earning an MFA. I mean, I don't know. Who knows, right? So I was looking at how much does it cost? Who has enrollment that I could do? What's it like for somebody who can't, like, go to campus every day, etc. And then I started to drill down. I was like, okay, so What can I focus my energy on that may do some small bit of good, will keep me away from just worrying about the news, but also won't be just kind of basking in my privilege? And it, the thought just came to me out of the blue. What about the Stephen King approach? What is the Stephen King approach? It's something I made up. Stephen King, obviously, fabulously famous author. Somebody I enjoy, although I don't enjoy everything he writes, but a lot of it has been really good stuff. If you don't like Shawshank Redemption, I'm sorry, we're going to disagree. But he is socially active. He actually does fight the power, such that it is. But he doesn't do it on the picket line. He doesn't do it by writing his congressman, although he might. He does it in fiction. He writes. And I thought, well, wait a minute. Here I am thinking about doing an MFA, and here's this need I have. What if they were the same thing? And I asked Claude about this, and Claude was very encouraging, because if there's one thing about these AIs, they really want to please you. And I'm constantly saying, stop blowing smoke up my ass. And it will, once you say that, but it kind of forgets after a while, you have to remind it. And we came up with this plan, and he was like, well, yes, this absolutely is if you wanted to write in such a way that you were making social commentary that wasn't direct, you would fix these two things you have. A way to help the world, for lack of a better term, and yes, I'm fully aware that this is the most minor thing in the world, and a way to fulfill that writing need that you have. And then, and this was my big epiphany, I realized I had another weight hanging over me, which was the Aurora Project. If you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you know that I have visited every Aurora in the United States in 2019, and then again in 2021. And I gathered all these pretty amazing stories, honestly, that I've not shared because I haven't been able to figure out how. I started that trip planning to make YouTube videos for each, and I did make some, and they're fine. I'm fine with how the videos came out. They're on my YouTube channel. You can watch them now. I've done a few different ones. But it didn't feel sufficient because the YouTube videos were done in a way that I was saying, hey, look at this interesting place, and look at the things that happened here, and you can come visit too. They were almost done as a place to visit segments. They should have been Tales from the Road segments. And this solves all my problems. And here's the plan. I take the Aurora Project and write it as a book with social commentary that documents 2019, 2021, and where we are today. And I can inject the social commentary that I think is important based on my interactions in these places. And it solves all the stuff that was weighing on me. I have found a way to deal with the news depression, shall we call it. I have found an outlet for my writing, and I found a way to finally reconcile the Aurora Project. Now, this may not sound like the biggest revelation in the world, but to me, it was huge because I didn't have any sense that all these three things could be solved with one project. But by talking with Claude, it became clear. This is what I need to do. And it was a big moment. I actually started crying in the truck when I thought of this, because it was so much of a relief to finally have a way to put aside frustration and find a project that made perfect sense that solved all these problems. Now, why am I talking about this in a van life podcast? Because this was a van life moment. This was me driving across the country in my rig, living van life at that moment, and using a new resource, this AI chat thing, to actually do some good for me. I mean, I don't know that I could use it to do good for others, maybe eventually, but for right now, it did good for me. 8-hour conversation. I have the whole thing recorded. It is an amazing thing for me to look at. And again, this is very personal. I may have just told you all that, and you might think that was the most boring thing you've ever heard. How silly. Anybody could have figured that out. I couldn't. It illustrated the value of psychotherapy at the same time it illustrated the value of AI. And no, AI is not psychotherapy. AI cannot have the responsibility that a trained psychotherapist can have. But the exercise we just went through actually had the same effect. If this were an actual therapy session, that would have been called a breakthrough. All I can tell you is it was a very big deal to me, and I'm making all kinds of plans right now to take advantage of this. I've signed up for the Write a Novel in a Month thing, which is now called Novel Writing Month, I think, because NaNoWriMo has died. I can't even get into all that. And it's great. It's wonderful. It's exactly what I needed right now. And that's the story. That's a tale from the road that, to me, has huge impact. And hey, folks, AI is very controversial. Any criticism you have against AI, I will probably agree with. But at the same time, it's also very, very useful. If you know how to use it properly and know what it is. It's like a crescent wrench. Crescent wrenches, or adjustable wrenches as they're properly called, are the worst tool. They are always the worst at whatever you're doing. They slip, the size changes, they're too big, the head gets in the way, they're terrible. But they're also the best tool because there's only one and it can do all those things. And AI is kind of like that. At any rate, that was my tale from the road. That's why I put it at the end. And heck, if you have any questions or anything, let me know. But I have started the book. The book is going to be all about my experiences in the Auroras and how what I saw there helped predict where we are now today. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 274. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. Remember, there's no episode next week. Episode 275 will be in 2 weeks. So please be there. We'll have that big announcement. Until next time, remember the words of Carl Jung. Seems appropriate. Your vision will become clear only when you can look into your own heart. Who looks outside dreams. Who looks inside awakes.